too much of a sense of audience is very dangerous for an artist. I often feel when I'm sending a painting out of the studio, nobody's going to like this. They're going to love that, but they're not going to like this. Sometimes I'm surprised, but I always feel I can't help it if they don't like it, because I'll stand by it because I think it's good. It's who and what I'm about.
There are many kinds of museums, from MoMA to Madame Tussauds, from Orange County to Red Square, and everywhere in between. But museum visitors only see a glimpse of the full picture. On this show, we open the crates, tell the stories, meet the people, and reveal the inner workings. Unseen, unheard, until now. From Philbrook Museum of Art and Public Radio Tulsa, I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential. In those prosperous years after World War II, when abstract expressionism was the talk of the art world, and names like Pollock and Rothko were entering the American mainstream, five women dared to enter this male-dominated space, not as muses, but as artists. From their New York studios where they worked, drank, fought, and loved, they kicked open the doors for themselves and everyone who came after. Today we'll get to know Lee, Grace, Helen, Joan, and Elaine, with author and Pulitzer Prize finalist Mary Gabriel. Mary spent the better part of a decade working on this project, which is now a book called Ninth Street Women. So, timing plays a big part of everything in the world, and of course, publishing is no exception to that. And it would be silly not to think about how the book coming out in this Me Too era and everything that's happening with gender politics and all these things impacts the book. But when you look at the book and you think about the research and time that went into it, I'm sure this project has been around much longer than the current environment that we're in. So where and when was the idea for this project born?
Yeah, the idea for this book arose out of a conversation I had with Grace Hardigan in 1990. So that was quite a long time ago. But I didn't start it until 2011. And it was definitely before the Me Too movement. But I have kind of a bit of luck in coming up with ideas. When I did my Marx book, everyone said, you know, no one's interested in Marx, that issue's dead.
And then this is Karl Marx, not Groucho. Yeah.
Right, yeah. And then the financial world collapsed. Lo and behold, the very moment when my book is coming out. So now with these women, even though I didn't plan it, I'm publishing it in the midst of the Me Too era. But I don't really think that this book, though, is necessarily addresses these Me Too issues, because these women never thought of themselves as in any way beleaguered because they were women. Lee Krasner did a little bit, but Joan, Helen, Grace certainly didn't. And Elaine, nothing impinged. You know, she was a force of nature. She was going to do what she was going to do, especially if someone told her not to do it. So I think that while it's interesting that there's a greater appreciation of women's history now and women's place in history and the injustices that women have suffered, among them women artists, that wasn't what I was thinking when I wrote the book, and I'm not sure how much this contributes to that kind of discussion.
So you mentioned 1990. You had this conversation with Grace Hardigan. We're talking almost 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But let's introduce the characters of the book. You just said them, and you're so I love the way you turn them into almost friends, and you refer to them by first name only. So will you introduce the characters of this particular story to us?
I'll start with Grace, because that's who I met first. I had been an art student in Baltimore, and Grace was the head of the painting department, the graduate painting department. And she was a formidable figure in every way, physically. You know, when she walked down the hall, you could hear her voice, you know, everywhere. She was all bombast. And she was terrifying. I mean, absolutely terrifying. And I was working at an art magazine after I graduated from art school and was assigned to interview her, and I was quaking because not only did I know of her from school, but I had had a couple different episodes with her. And in fact, at one point, my then boyfriend and I went to a party at her loft, and he, of course, did what someone has to do at every art party, which is something outrageous, and so we were thrown out. So as I was waiting at Grace's door, I thought, oh my gosh, she's going to remember me. But I realized after meeting her and knowing her that what happened with him and me was minor in her in her experiences of outrageous behavior. So Grace Hartigan was what was called a second-generation artist. She came after the de Kooning and the Pollock and the big breakthroughs of the 40s among the men. And Grace walked into that scene having had absolutely no real training as an artist. She was a wartime bride. She'd married a guy who was an accountant in New York City. They were going to try to move to Alaska. They got as far as Los Angeles, ran out of money. She got pregnant. You know, it was disappointment after disappointment. And then he realized he was going to be drafted because the Pearl Harbor attack had just happened. And so Grace, just trying to find something to do to kind of lift her spirits, went with her husband to some drawing courses at a local high school and realized that there was something powerful happening there for her. She said she felt nervous. She was sweating. She started to, she felt like she was going to start to cry. And she wasn't quite sure where that was coming from. But that small introduction in that most informal and banal kind of setting awakened in her this love of art, and she started pursuing it on her own. Even though she had a son, an infant son, she sort of neglected him in order to pursue art. And when she moved back east, she met, through a number of introductions that weren't worth going into, she met an art teacher who was going to teach her about modern art. Well, Grace had a way of attracting men, and this guy became a lover. Her husband was away at war, and the two of them, Ike Muse, her teacher, and Grace, moved to New York City. And Grace was prepared to become an artist, but she didn't realize that that's not at all what Ike had in mind. Ike was looking for someone to support him. He was a young woman, 15 years his junior, who was ready to support him while he pursued his art. In 1948, in January, Grace had an incredible awakening, and it was because she saw Jackson Pollock's first drip show. And that was really a moment where, second to her experience of drawing in Los Angeles, that was the second moment in her life where she realized, this is something I have to do, and all else be damned. And it wasn't that she wanted to paint like Pollock. It's just that he opened this door to her, as he did to so many artists, to say, you can do this. You can go as far as you want. You can be as crazy as you want. No excuses, no restraint. And that was exactly what she needed to hear.
So in 1948, when that happens, this revelation happens with Grace Hartigan, that's only 3 years prior to this show that from which the book draws its name. Before we go into introducing some of our other characters, talk about the show that inspired the title for the book in 1951.
The Ninth Street Show. Yeah. It's really an interesting show that's been sort of neglected historically. You know, when you look at the history of art in the United States, you hear about the Armory Show, even though it was European.
This is 1913. When was
that? I think that was 1913.
Yeah, the Armory Show.
That's famous. People learn about that. But the Ninth Street Show, they really don't know about. And yet it was absolutely seminal to the introduction to international audiences, American first and international audience, that there was such a thing as a modern American artist. And it was a show that some people, but in 1950, just before, I'll just backtrack a minute, before artists agreed to sort of hold this show, the greater world had begun discovering the artists in New York. And immediately as they began discovering them, they started misinterpreting them. And so the artists realized that in order to declare themselves, they had to do it on their own terms in a show. And so in May 1951, they came across a furniture store on 9th Street in Greenwich Village that was in a building that was going to be demolished, and the space was empty. So they rented it for a month. Some say 2 months, but I think it's a month. Whitewashed it, knocked down walls, put in lighting, made a massive exhibition space over two floors, ground floor and the basement, and hung art by artists that today everyone knows, de Kooning, Pollock, Rauschenberg, Bob Motherwell, Rothko, all of the artists who we now associate as the deans of modern art of America were there. And yet really the only one who was a household name at that time was Pollock, and that's because he'd appeared in Life magazine. So this was a complete coming out.
And so this changes people's perception from Paris had been the place.
Right.
Paris was the center of the art world. And slowly but surely, that starts to drift and become more and more about New York. And this show was right at the center of making that happen.
It was. This show was the declaration. This was their, if they were all debutantes, this was their coming out party. And this show did it. And after that, one of the women I interviewed, Mary Abbott, a really tremendous painter, said, after the Ninth Street show, the scene became a scene. You know, before then, it had just been a bunch of friends hanging around together. And then everybody wanted in on it, you know.
And so Grace Hartigan is in this show.
She's in this show.
And then how about, who's our next person?
All right, I'll go to Lee. I'll start chronologically. Lee was the, Lee Krasner, who eventually married Jackson Pollock, was the oldest of the group. The age difference between them is 20 years. Lee is the oldest. Helen Frankenthaler.
She's born in 1908, I believe.
1908, right. Yeah. So she was definitely among the first generation of these painters. She was in among a handful, literally about 10 painters at the very, very beginning in the 1930s, when the whole notion of modern art, you know, that there's a possibility that Americans could do modern art, that they could move beyond the European forefathers and try something on their own. Lee was among the few women. There were maybe two others at that time who were involved in that small grouping. And she was a central figure in the art movement in New York, not just because of her work, which was avant-garde, but because of her eye. She was said to have the best eye in the country for painting in the 40s. And also because she was an activist in support of artists. And that started with the WPA in the 30s during the Depression. Lee was one of the people who organized protests on behalf of artists. So whenever the government tried to cut funding, it was Lee who would organize the groups of people to march up Fifth Avenue. And so she was really a central figure. And it's in the history of art, when people talk about the abstract expressionists, they often introduce Lee only when they introduce Pollock, which is 1941, 1942, when he kind of arrives on the scene, not physically, but his art does. But in fact, Lee was a seminal figure 12 years before that, and she was the artist. She had the name. When they met, he was no one, and her friends were shocked watching her promote him and sort of recede to the background because she had been one of the foremost artists on the scene. So Lee Krasner is another one, and she was in the Ninth Street Show. Next chronologically is Elaine de Kooning. Elaine de Kooning was born Elaine Fried in Brooklyn, and she was one of these people who, she once said, I think it was a minister told her, being married to you must be like being married to 20 people. And she said, you know, I wonder, is that a compliment? But that's who she was. She did everything. She wanted her hand in every pie, and she was a painter, she was a writer, she was an organizer, she was the person who was sort of the social secretary of the scene.
But not in a dilettante.
Not
kind
in
of
a
way.
Dilettante way at all. She was completely full on and great at it. You know, when I say she was a social secretary, she didn't just throw parties. She invited pivotal figures to join. You know, she recognized the young poets, for example, John Ashbery, Frank O'Hara, Kenneth Koch.
This is what was known as the New York School.
The New York School. Before they were in New York School, and they were a bunch of guys at this point before Barbara Guest arrived, a bunch of guys who'd just come down from Harvard and really were just hanging around. Elaine saw that they were artistic orphans because the poetry they were writing was so far outside the mainstream of what was acceptable that they didn't have anyone fighting their corner in the literary scene. And so Elaine said, come on, hang around with us. And they did. And they were inspired by the older artists. So she did the same thing with the composers. And so Elaine was this person, this kind of queen.
Kind of this, almost like this Gertrude Stein
exactly.
kind of figure.
If she had had a home, she could have had a salon. Mm. But she and Bill were always so broke that they had, I think they had four chairs, so they could only ever invite two people over.
Now you say Bill, her husband was famously Willem de Kooning.
Yeah.
So she has the most famous last name of this group.
Right.
Did you ever come to view that as a burden on kind of her breaking out as her own individual?
Yeah. You know, I'm sure it was, but I don't think she ever saw it as such because she married him when they were, I mean, she started dating him when they were 18. So really for her entire adult life, that's who she was. So I don't think she ever thought of it as a burden. Lee Krasner criticized her for using de Kooning's name, But I think in Elaine's mind, she was proud. You know, she loved him and respected him, and she was proud to be associated with him. So I don't ever think she did. She made a distinction, though, in signing her name. She made, on her painting, she would write E-D-E-K. And, you know, it's a little bit of a novel way of writing de Kooning. But other than that, she never acknowledged that that was in any way a mistake or that that was responsible for her not getting the recognition she should have.
And so continuing in kind of our journey, chronologically, we move from Elaine to Grace.
Grace.
Right? And we touched about Grace. Right. And then last is Helen Frankenthaler.
Well, Joan Mitchell.
Or Joan Mitchell,
yeah,
rather.
Joan Mitchell, age-wise, is next. She comes on the scene last. But Joan Mitchell was a fascinating character, really one of the most difficult to write about, but also one of the most interesting. And that's because Joan was... she's from Chicago, born to a very wealthy family, had an extremely privileged, materially a privileged existence in childhood. But personally, her childhood was an utter nightmare. She had a very abusive father who, first, for the beginning of her life, completely ignored her because he wanted a son. And then when he realized how talented she was, you know, what a fabulous artist she was and how talented she was at basically anything she tried to do, which she did to please him, he became obsessional about her and, you know, and focused all of his energy on developing her. And so she was never allowed to have fun. But Joan emerged from that experience in childhood a really abrasive character. And she was the kind of person who, like Pollock, actually, like Jackson Pollock, you probably wouldn't want to know or meet, but her art was fantastic. You know, that she transcended whatever pain she had inside her to create the most beautiful canvases. Oftentimes people, when they talk about women's work, they'll call it lyrical and it's kind of a put down. But in Joan's case, it really wasn't. It's not a put down. It's magnificent work. So this light and this beauty comes out in her work, even though inside she was sort of tortured and her personal relationships were always extremely complicated.
So Helen Frankenthaler, much like Elaine and much like Lee, did at one point have another painter as a spouse. So she was married to Robert Motherwell.
Right.
And she's the one who passed away the most recently. She only passed away a couple of years, a few years ago. Yeah. And she was part of a field known as color field. Can you kind of explain what that area was and what that means?
Right. Well, Helen did a famous painting in 1952, which was called Mountains and Sea. And she hadn't ever worked like this before. She'd been away on a holiday in Nova Scotia and had a lot of landscape, she said, stored in her arms. And so she tacked an unprimed canvas on the floor, which meant it didn't have a coating on it. The paint could actually seep into it. And instead of painting on top of the surface, she turned her paint, her oil paint, into liquid with turpentine so that it would ooze into the fabric. And as she did that, it created large puddles. And where the puddles... where the different colors overlapped, wonderful sort of events would occur that were unpredictable, that she had no control over. And this painting to her was a revelation. She wasn't sure what she'd done, like any great work of art. You know, the artist rarely knows what, in fact, they did. And so she shared a studio with another painter, Friedel Zubas, and he came over and looked at it and said, you know, oh, I've got to, you know, you've got to show people this painting. That was the beginning of what was called the Colorfield School. But when Helen painted that painting, no one understood it. Even her closest friends, when it was in the first show, I think it was in the fall of 1952 when she exhibited that, even people who had supported her previously didn't know what to do with it. They called it, they thought that she had a lack of activity or a lack of engagement in the canvas. They didn't understand that what she had done was actually create a new way of painting, that you don't paint on a canvas, you paint in the canvas. And so two painters from Washington, D.C. saw this work in her studio when Helen wasn't there. And they were so struck by it, you know, the earth literally moved under their feet because they had been looking for a way into their own painting. And as Grace had done with Pollock, and as Lee had done with Pollock, and as Elaine had done with Bill de Kooning, and as Joan Mitchell had done with Bill de Kooning, these two saw Helen's work and said, this is where I go with my own. And so they created something called the Colorfield School, which is using her technique. But when that school was written about, Helen was never given credit, really, as being the originator of this. And, you know, you could say it's because the primary champion of that movement was a critic named Clem Greenberg, who had been Helen's lover for 5 years. And they had an agreement that he wouldn't write about her. because they were intimate. And that could be one reason why she wasn't given the credit she deserved. Another could have been because she was a woman.
Yeah, I mean, those gender politics seem to come into play. That, right. And especially that's such a great example. You know, they did have this measure of freedom. And when you talk about things like feminism, those terms didn't really exist in the way that they did then. So it's hard to kind of put labels from contemporary.
Right.
You know, it's very difficult.
Hey, Jeff, guess what?
What's that, Scott?
This episode of Museum Confidential is sponsored by Prince.
Oh, man, I love Prince.
No, not Prince as in 1999 or Little Red Corvette. We're talking about Prince here, as in printmaking.
Oh, Prince.
Don't give me that guff, Jeff. Prints are just as exciting as prints. Think about it. You've got lithography, engraving, etching, monotype, woodcut, aquatint, dry point, and so many other techniques.
Huh. Geez, I never thought about it that way.
No problem, Jeff. That's what I'm here for. Anyway, let's hear it for Prince. You know, the other one.
And like I said, I love the way you refer to it. They become almost like our friends when mm-hmm. we're reading through the book, especially the way you, and I'm sure you do this because of the last name problem in a certain
no,
way.
No, I didn't. It's
use
funny.
Their first names.
I didn't. That wasn't at all why I did it. I did it because that's how I felt about them. You know, if I'm going to spend 7 years with a group of people, by God, I'm going to get to know them. You know, they're going
it was
to
also very
like
evocative
friends.
To me, at least, of Little Women in terms yeah. of their different personalities. It was instead of, you know, Amy and Joe and Meg, you know,
yeah,
it's
yeah.
all these different things. So I really loved the way you did that. But I wonder, mentioning that 20-year age mm-hmm. difference, you know, we're talking about different generations
right.
and different ways of thinking about mm-hmm. the world. But did they caucus together in any real sense and see themselves as any unit of advocacy or anything?
No. I mean, this group of women?
Yeah, this group
no,
of women.
No, not at all. They were absolutely enmeshed in this larger group of artists. You know, they didn't think of themselves as a subgroup. They were groupings of friends. Lee and Helen shared a studio for a period of time. Very interestingly, that was the period when Lee came out of that studio share doing some fantastic work, work that was the first time Pollock really said, you're on to something. Helen and Grace were really good friends and spent a lot of time looking at each other's work and helping each other's work and fed off of it. You can see Grace did one painting in 1952. Helen came back and did kind of her version of it. You can see that dialogue. Joan was much more independent, but she and Elaine were very good friends. So they were part of that world, and they did socialize with one another. But they never were part of any kind of... There was one attempt in the late 50s by a woman artist I don't talk about in the book to have kind of a group think, you know, at her studio. What should we do? You know, how should we come out as women? And I think Elaine and Joan went, but it didn't go anywhere. I mean, they just didn't think of themselves that way. They were artists. They weren't women artists. And in fact, they were really annoyed whenever anyone asked them about that. There was a famous party where Elaine and Joan were had attended, and a man came up to them and said, well, how does it feel to be women artists? And Joan said, you know, let's get out of here. I mean, they just couldn't even deal with it. It was such a ridiculous question.
So Grace Hartigan in that moment had, I guess you could argue, kind of not immediate, but she had true success and mm-hmm. was a star
right.
of sorts. And now that all these artists have passed away, and as with so many artists, value and interest and things change over mm-hmm. time, you know, people rise and fall in the terms mm-hmm. of public. Where do you kind of view these five artists now in 2018 in terms of who's kind of the most well-known
yes.
and regarded and how yeah. those things have changed over time?
Yeah. Grace was, in her period in the 50s, very successful. You know, she was really the artist. Today, I think of all five of the women I write about, probably Grace and Elaine are the ones who are least well-known. At the moment, Joan Mitchell's having a real resurgence. Helen Frankenthaler is also... She's always been well-regarded and well-represented by galleries and among critics, and she never really disappeared. Lee has had ups and downs. You know, she was the first woman to be given a retrospective at MoMA in 1984, but it was an uphill struggle for her to get any kind of recognition, and she really fought hard for many years. But once again, she's sort of coming back. So I think basically it's a wonderful time right now because... And this is where the Me Too movement comes into it. Because there is this sort of recognition that women, the history of women has been lost in all areas across the board, but especially in the arts, people are looking, investors are looking. I mean, surprisingly, collectors are looking and saying, who's out there? Where should we, you know, who should we be looking at? And so all of their, you know, as the tide rises, all of their ships are rising. And I think with Grace, part of her problem was that she'd moved to Baltimore in her later years, which was artistically nowhere. And so she was lost. Elaine became involved. She was always painting, but because she was Elaine, she was involved in 15 other things. And she was very involved in social justice issues in the 60s and 70s. And so I think she wasn't as preoccupied with making a name for herself as an artist. She never was. You know, she said, I didn't become an artist to gain recognition. I became an artist to paint. So I think right now, probably Joan Mitchell, Helen Frankenthaler, Lee, and then Elaine and Helen are sort of only being rediscovered.
Yeah, and it seems like all of them are ripe for some interesting reappraisal. Yeah. Thanks for taking the time. The book was great, and thank you for taking on such a big project.
Oh, it's
my
great pleasure.
The January 1971 issue of Art News featured a piece by art historian and prominent feminist Linda Nochlin titled, Why Have There Been No Great Women Artists? In the article, she challenged and explored assumptions inside the title question. Nochlin argued that significant societal barriers prevented women from pursuing careers in art, including restrictions on education and what she referred to as, quote, the entire romantic, elitist, individual glorifying and monograph producing substructure upon which the profession of art history is based. And decades earlier, in her landmark 1949 book, The Second Sex, French existentialist Simone de Beauvoir said, quote, to tell the truth, one is not born a genius, one becomes a genius, and the feminine situation has, up to the present, rendered this becoming practically impossible. That's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory at the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. To learn more about what's going on at the museum and at the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. We suggest both. Until next time, look closer.